right. We're in 1 Samuel 13. We saw kind of some stuff last week where Saul started to assume the reins of power. Again, there was never there was no kingship to follow the rules. He was the rule setter. Bit of controversy in the fact that a Benjamite was appointed the king, and God promised him, if you'll do right by me and do right by the people, your kingship will last forever. Which seems kind of an oxymoron, because the tribe of Judah was going to be the kingly line, and it was going to be the Messiah line. So you can look at that as, although God picked him and let the people pick him, he knew he was going to fail. And that's that. You can get into some predestination stuff there that I'm not smart enough to argue. So we'll start with 1 Samuel 13. So I copied the first verse out of the actual Jewish Bible, translated into English, because nobody can seem to make heads or tails. There's all kind of conjecture. And it says, Shaul, which is Hebrew for what we call Saul, was blank years old when he began to reign. And he had ruled Israel for 2 years. So there's a lot of stuff in here about this being lost in translation, in that it doesn't tell us how. Nobody knows how old he was. There's all kind of conjecture. There's different older Hebrew words, newer Hebrew words for the years. And then obviously, he reigned for more than 2 years. It was like his reign was actually closer to 40 years. So just to show you that there is some controversy in there, that contrivancy is what our British friends call it. And so I copied out of the Hebrew Bible. It's not in there either. So you can make with that. It's not really a big deal. And I just thought I'd point it out, in that there is some stuff in there. When you're reading that, it doesn't tell you how old he is and how long he reigned. You'll see another place in here, I think we'll get to it today, where some numbers are screwed up. So it's weird in the older Hebrew numbers. The word for the numbers changed in translation, because there's actually a point, I think it says 30,000 chariots. Well, they only have 3,000 troops. So unless a guy could ride like 10 chariots at one time, so they think it was, the word should have been 3,000, but it was translated 30,000. So neither here nor there, but just thought I'd point it out since we're here. When he chose 3,000 of Israel's men, 2,000 of them were with Sheol in Machmaz and the hills of Beth-El, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeon Benjamin. The rest of the people were sent back to their respective tents. So basically that says Saul had 1,000 men with him and his son Jonathan. That's what the Jonathan was up in, more of the, where the tribe of Benjamin was. He had 1,000 men with him, and the rest of the people went home. Saul had 2,000 and he had one. So now we'll go. That was the only part I copied out of the actual Hebrew Bible. I thought it was interesting to kind of see it the way it was, the way they would speak it. So Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it, and Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard it, said Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines, and the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. So, one little interesting thing here, you can kind of almost see it, you can look at it two different ways. Saul blew the trumpet, and the message that Israel got was, Saul had defeated the Philistines, the garrison of the Philistines. Well, who had defeated the Philistines, actually? His son Jonathan. And this is going to be a pattern. Now, you could just say they're just putting it to the kingship of Saul had defeated the garrison. But in reality, his son had done it, and you're going to see more and more that he tries to hold on to all the glory. He's trying to hold on to, you'll see he doesn't have enough faith to say, God made me king, and I'm going to be king, and he's constantly trying to be reinforced and to be, it shows how we saw a guy that was very humble and very, had a good heart in the beginning, and God made him a new man, and all these things, and you're just going to see he had every chance, like us, and again, he's no different than any other human. He had every chance to be everything God had meant him to be, and he just blew it. He just couldn't let God sit above him on the throne and trust that. He had to keep reinforcing himself that he was on the throne and it was going to be his decisions. He was going to make the decisions and God was going to agree with him. That's pretty much what you're going to see here, which is a plight that we all have.
I think it's neat that he says, let the Hebrews hear, and then afterwards it says, all Israel. And I think that that's a play in words, too, because the Hebrew is a traveler. I mean, that's what it meant. I mean,
right.
That was what they originally called Hebrews, because they just traveled, right? And I think that that's, and I think when someone realizes that they're here and just traveling, that they're able to hear from the Lord and be ready for battle.
That's a good point. Excellent. Verse 5. And the Philistines mustered to fight Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore, and they came up and camped at Mishmash to the east of Beth Haven. So that's where the 30,000 chariots, they think that's a misinterpretation. Doesn't matter. They just eventually that would be like every troop had their own chariot. There was nobody just running, which not how armies were set up at this time. Chariots were pretty expensive commodity, and not everybody got to be a charioteer. Unlike Ben-Hur. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and tombs and cisterns. Some Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still in Gilgal, and the people followed him trembling. It's weird, because when I read verse 6, I can't help but think about the verses in the Bible where the people hide the rocks in the caves and they play for the rocks to fall on them. So I don't think that really fits here, but you can't help but
Judges, the beginning of Judges, when they were attacked, that's when they dug all these places.
Yeah. So it just shows that they are fear. I don't think there's much you can make spiritually from that. We're all, you know, all of us can fall into that category.
Well, the other interesting thing is they followed him trembling. In most of the stories of the Judges, when they were, he said, send the ones that are afraid away.
Well, and again, it's kind of interesting because they were like, we want a king to fight our battles. So here, God gave them what they wanted. You have a king now. And now they have to line up behind him. So, but it's interesting that some Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan. So they left, out of fear, they left the promise. They left the promise that God was going to give them, keep them there, and if they would do what was right, he promised them he would keep them in that land in peace and safety. And they've become so fearful they're willing to give up the promise. They're willing, again, you apply that to our own lives. When you become, you know, scared with everything going on in the world and your heart wants to just race and things going on, you can forget the promise. I mean, it's really right. You know, personally, you know, when I got sick with the cancer and all that stuff and the struggles, I really, really wrestled with God. And I, you know, part of the problem is you give God promises to you that he never gave you. You know, you're like, I'm on your team. I'm one of the good guys. This shouldn't happen to me. None of this should happen to me. I'm with you. And you promised me, and it's like, nah, that's not what you were promised. You were not promised a perfect life. But it's A1 example. It's hard when you're in the midst of that storm to be like, this ain't what I was expecting. You know, even today, this isn't the life I expected. So it's just a wrestle. You know, we can all fall into this trap. And we can all leave the prophets.
So 7 are people that didn't hide. They just left.
Yes.
And that, it's kind of neat that he says they were in danger where they were distressed. And when there's a lot of stress in your life,
that's the point.
Place when there's danger. Am I going to hide?
Or am I going to live on the promises? Yep.
We're going to talk about it. I told Minnie last week, it's funny where we are and where we are.
And again, you know, it sometimes it's... I'm attracted to the Old Testament a lot of times just for the... Because sometimes you want to say, what a bunch of idiots. How could they... You know, God just spoke to them and did this. But then you're like, when you turn that mirror on yourself, you're like, how many times... Human nature is human nature. And I believe that's how Satan so easily manipulates that, because he's seen human nature for how many thousand years, and nobody does anything different, you know, other than by faith. Nobody does anything different. Humans, you know, I remember being a kid in elementary school when you got your first, microscope, and you could touch the amoeba and see it move, because everything wants to live. And everything reacts the same way. And Satan has seen that human nature over time and knows what buttons to push and how you're going to react. In most cases, without faith. Now, with faith changes everything. That's a scripture, right? Oh, so I wanted to show you where kind of, if it matters. You'll see Bethel, there's Gilgal, where the white this here is. And this is where Saul is. And all around this purple up here, the purple up here is where they are camped. So they're not far from Jerusalem. But it just shows you how far east, where the purple is, how far east that the Philistines have pushed into the promised land at this time. So he waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, bring the burnt offering to me and the peace offering, and he offered the burnt offering. Well, and I want to read, so we can go back to 1 Samuel 10, verses 8 and 9. This is Samuel talking to Saul. It says, I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do. As Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. So that's what Samuel, that's the direct orders that he got from Samuel. Wait. So it's kind of like if you go back and look at the history of all the times that Israel, when God said, that army's too big, make it smaller, make it small. His faith was surface deep at this point. All he's looking at is, hey, the longer I sit here and do nothing, the more people get scared and the more people leave. I got to do something. I have to do something. You know what? To flip this script a little bit, I have sat in churches where I'm just trying to, you're going through something in your life and you're just trying to, and the church is like, you have to do something. You need to be in Sunday school. You need to serve Sunday school. You need to, you know, be in children's church. You need to be whatever. And there are people that are going to press you to do something. Now, there's a time, there's a season for everything. But just to make blanket statements that you need to do something is not scriptural. There is a time and a season, and you have to find that time and season. Now, people can press and say, look, anybody out there, if you're feeling led, we could use the help. And that's, I'm sure, that's everything in life. But there's also, I have been in those high pressure, it's like an Amway sale for Jesus, right? So They're just pressured. You're being pressured and pressured and pressured to do something. And it ain't always the case. And you will make the mistakes that just got made. Maybe the consequences might not be so big. So what has happened here, unbeknownst to him, is he has assumed the role of king and priest. Now, you could be prophet and priest. He was a prophet and a king, but there is only one guy that can be king and priest. And he just violated that picture in front of the people and in front of God. So there's going to be... So when you look at it on the thing, you can understand humanly, he's seeing his army scrambled, he's getting a little... You know, worried, he's like, I got to do something or I'm going to, you know, it's going to be me versus the Philistines. So he makes the offering. He takes on the role of the priest when Samuel explicitly told him, don't do this, I'm going to get there. And again, it's all the things in your life that God's going to test you, and I am horrible with my patience. And God's going to test you, be patient. I'm coming, I promise you, I'll be there. You're not here, God. I got to do something, right? I'm going to step out in faith, you know. And there's sometimes that's a, you know, like a Bugs Bunny car, Roadrunner cartoon, you know, the coyote. You just stepped off the cliff, and it's been an interesting life at times for all of us. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came and Saul went out to meet him and greet him. I think it's kind of funny that the two opposite reactions of I can't help but picture the Garden of Eden in this. When, you know, Adam and Eve had sinned, they wouldn't hit and make God look for them. Saul's on the other side. He's going to go out and say, hey, guess what I just did? You know, you weren't here, so I did this. But he's going to start making all kinds. You'll see his kingship becomes one big excuse after the other. All his failures he blames on somebody else, something else. He never seems to accept responsibility. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, when I saw the people were scattering from me and did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines had mustered at Mishmash, I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. I forced myself. That's an interesting, the devil made me do it kind of thing. Who remembers? What was that comedian? Flip Wilson, right? The devil made me do it. Always some kind of excuse, but here, again, violating the word you got from the Lord, have faith, be steady, and doing something out of step and saying, well, I'm seeking favor with the Lord. You can't have it both ways, right? If the Lord told you through a prophet, don't do this, wait on me, I'll be there, but then you say, well, I'm going to find the Lord's favor by going ahead and doing it. It's, you know, it's little kids. It's us. It's a human, again, human condition.
Mm-hmm. New King James says, I felt compelled.
And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you, for the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Again, it goes back into the predestination thing. It's kind of a weird thing that Samuel had to make somebody from Benjamin king when he knew the tribe of Judah was supposed to be the kingly line. But and then God said, hey, it'll last forever if you do right, all the well knowing that wasn't going to happen. But he gave the people what they wanted. So I think he just... Sometimes you get what you want very hard and very cold. But now your kingdom will not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. So this verse right here is going to guide the rest of Saul's kingship. From this point on, he was, you know, giving in to temptations and, you know, doing bad things. But right now, in front of his face, Samuel just told him, you're going to be replaced. You've screwed up that bad. Again, you can look at it on the surface, doesn't look that bad. But when you realize he assumed the role of prophet, I mean king and priest, it's really, really bad in God's sight. So, but this will control the rest of his decisions. And Samuel rose and went up from Gilgal, and the rest of the people went up after Saul to meet the army. They went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. And Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. And Saul and Jonathan his son and the people who were present with them stayed in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped at Mishmash. So if you go back to that map, that's where Mishmash is, where that thing is. So you can see here that it was kind of interesting in a couple other places. You'll see when Samuel's with Saul and they go to leave, Saul becomes so unhinged, he constantly wants Samuel to be seen with him because he thinks that'll reassure the people. But in this case, Samuel went a different way and let Saul go by himself. So you can look at some significance in that if he had listened and let Samuel do, Samuel would have went with him because the Lord would have went with him. But conjecture. And raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One turns toward Ophrah in the land of Shaul, and the other company turned toward Bethoron, and the other company turned the border that looks down at the valley of Zeboam towards the wilderness. I don't know what you can make about that, in the sense that it's kind of odd that this is how all the time that the Israel has victory over the Philistines, they divided their companies into three groups of three. So I don't know if the Philistines are saying, well, that worked for them, maybe it'll work for us, or if it's just a natural way that kind of military conquest was conducted in those days. So now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews again make themselves swords or spears." But every one of the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, or his sickle. So there you see the Philistines had learned ironworks. And that was a big, big advantage in warfare. So if any of the Israelites did keep a piece of ironworks for their agricultural needs, they, you know, it's kind of funny. To me, this is universal background checks. This is the Philistines knowing exactly who has the iron sickles, the iron hoes, the iron pitchforks, all the implements of that day. The Philistines know who has them because they have to pay them to sharpen them. So consider this universal background. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares and for the mattock, and 1/3 of a shekel for sharpening axes and for setting the goads. So they actually had to pay to get, you know, obviously as you use these things, they would become duller. So you had to pay to use your own tool. Kind of like paying property tax on your house after you've paid it off. You know, the government's never quite satisfied with you being done. So on the day of the battle, there was neither sword nor spear to be found in the hand of any of the people with Saul or Jonathan, but Saul and Jonathan, his son, had them. So I don't know how that came about. It doesn't really give you, but, you know, luckily they had, at least they had a weapon, but obviously two guys against a whole army, you know. But then again, you never know when the Lord steps in what happens. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Mishmash. So I guess they're leaving through the way that they're going to go out of this place. So that's where it ended. So I kind of cut it off there as a line of thought.
Just in the line of Luke in this, the two swords, remember Jesus said, "Go buy swords," and then they said, "We only have two," instead of three off. And so you have the whole of Israel, two swords.
There you go. So
something to go.
Mm-hmm. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. You know, what do you do with that? He's kind of being brave, but not telling his father. So you could make argument that it's a foolhardy gesture in that now his dad doesn't know where part of his army is, but he's got one of two swords, you know, so now I have half my swords are gone out that I don't even know about. But on the other hand, Saul, maybe Jonathan seeing how many dumb decisions his dad makes, so he's like, I'm not even going to tell him about this one. I'm not going to let him get involved, so I don't know.
Or his dad wouldn't let him go.
Right, right. So
better to say sorry than ask permission.
Yeah. Forgiveness and permission. So Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron. So you can kind of say he's kind of scared and hiding a little bit too. And the people who were with him were about 600. And Ahaz, the son of Atub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, priest of the Lord of Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan is gone. So, basically, if you'll remember, I always want to call him Phinehas and Ferb, but Phinehas and his brother were not really believers. And they had died, but here's one of their son just assumed wearing an ephod. He doesn't tell you whether he's good or bad, but if you'll remember, the Lord said, I'm removing, your family will no longer be the priest. So we're going to see a facade of religiosity injected in here. And, you know, again, in the battles of our own lives, how many facades of religiosity do we put on and, you know, and go into battle. All right. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on one side and a rocky crag on the other. And the name of one was Bozes, and the other was Senech. And one crag rose to the north in front of Mishash, and the other was from the south. I wasn't sure if there was something salient in that, or if it's just kind of making sure you know that, you know, there's a north and a south. It's kind of funny throughout the whole Bible and even in the book of Revelation, all the bad things to Israel come from the north. And they're invaded, it always says they're invaded from the north. Seems to be, not always, but that seems to be a big theme that, you know, all the bad things come from the north. And Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of the uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by a few. And his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, do as you wish, behold, I am with you heart and soul. So, to be honest with you, like, I kind of, victim of Sunday school, right? In a sense, not bad. But you kind of always picture Jonathan and David. That's kind of that, you know, David was going to be king and Jonathan was attracted to him. Now, reading these verses, you kind of wonder if it was kind of the other way around. Jonathan's always got people that love him to death, like, or are just willing to do anything for him. So you kind of wonder if, you know, we always had that David was kind of the higher up and Jonathan was drawn to him. What if God put Jonathan in David's life to draw him to him to kind of protect? You'll see he'll become a buffer between him and his father. But he's just a really, really interesting character. Here he has great faith. I mean, you would think this would kind of be a dumb move, you know, but he basically says, hey. And you'll see he kind of almost does the Gideon thing where it's like lay out the fleece kind of thing. You know, it's going to be this thing. We're going to do this, and if the Lord says this, we're going to do this. But if not, we'll do this. It's kind of interesting.
But it also is showing the difference between Jonathan and Saul.
Yeah, he's hiding in the cave.
No, he's hiding in the cave. He's out for battle. Jonathan's looking to believe that the Lord is with him. And Saul figures he's not because Samuel's not with him. So he, it's like the two, he, Jonathan and Saul are like two extremes. In the coming, even if Jonathan's his son.
Right. Agreed. And Jonathan stepped, well, this is a point where he's saying maybe the Lord will be with us, where Saul surrounded himself with the fake priest. Mm-hmm. And we're even going to see the Ark of the Covenant again. It's like, didn't you guys learn anything from last time? You know, again, when you point
mirror,
those
mirror,
fingers,
mirror,
yeah,
mirror,
there's a whole bunch pointing back at you. And then again, his armor bearer said that, do all that's in your heart, do as you wish, behold, I'm with you heart and soul. And that kind of reminds me of the relationship that David had with Jonathan, like this really deep relationship. But here, his armor bearer, this guy's like, man, he's gutsy. He's like, all right, just two of us, but if you say let's go, let's go. You know, I'm with you. So I kind of try to make the connection. There's always the unnamed servant that's, I'm not sure that plays out here. I don't know how you would kind of make that case that, you know. So I was looking at it. So if you look at the armor of God, and who's carrying that armor for you before you get it is your unnamed servant, the Holy Spirit, right? He's the one bringing that armor to you and making sure you know how to use it. So it's kind of interesting. I could get that out of there, but, you know, for what that's worth. Then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men, and we show ourselves to them. As they say to us, wait until we come up to you, then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into your hand, and this shall be assigned to us. Again, it goes back to Gideon and the fleece and all that. And, you know, just Jonathan has apparently this solid a relationship with the Lord that he's willing to say, hey, the Lord wants us to do this. He's going to talk to me right now. He's going to talk to me in the midst of this battle. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. So, you know, he's going to act on, you got to remember with Gideon, he did the fleece. He had to have a second thing. He said, okay, the fleece is wet and the ground's dry, but tomorrow I want the fleece to be dry and the ground, or the first time the fleece was dry and the ground was wet. And I want to see this again. I want to see the fleece wet and the ground dry. So he needed a second reassurance, and Jonathan's like, now I'm good. We're good. Let's go. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer, killed them after him. And the first strike which Jonathan and his armor bearer made killed about 20 men within where half a furlough's length of an acre of land. I never got really what that, why he gave, unless it's just telling you, hey, it was a real close quarter thing. They were in really, I don't know if everybody heard this term, CQB, close quarter battle. But he's like, hey, they were in a small space and he killed 20 of them on the first go round. So.
Because the Lord went ahead.
Yep.
The Lord went ahead, and so he felt very confident that they were going to win. And the army leader was very trusting of who he was following. As he followed the Lord, the army leader was like, can you imagine? He's trusting him with his life. He's like, yeah, I'm going to die, you're going to die, but we're not going to die. I mean, I think they both had that faith because of their association. His maybe with his master, and the master's with the Lord.
Right, so you would have to obviously say, you know, not taking the spiritual, supernatural involved, that for this armor bearer to follow Jonathan this closely, he's had to show him his faith through many, many, many things where he's like, nah, this guy's in good with the Lord and we're going, you know, and they have us surrounded. We got them just where we want them. And it's an interesting And there was, oh, go ahead, Rose.
No, I just find that fascinating.
Yep.
That kind of trust, a friend that trusts you.
With his life.
And to do what is right.
Well, is he trusting him or is he trusting the concept of what, or what Jonathan's saying? God is able to save by many or few. So he's not really, he's saying do what's in your heart.
Yeah.
You know, because you're trusting the Lord.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's not so much him just following him. It's the fact that he's following Jonathan because he's trusting the Lord.
Yeah. Follow me
as
I follow him.
Yep. And there was panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. So obviously, the Lord has stepped in supernaturally, and I'm assuming this is some sort of earthquake, whether it be, you know, a minor, very localized thing or a big, doesn't really tell you, but God's basically saying, I'm in it. Yep, here we go. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, count and see who has gone from us. And they had counted, and behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here, for the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. So, again, his son is out taking action and doing things, and he's still trying to put on religion. You know, let's pray about it before, you know, before we do anything. Let's get our religiosity on. Get the prayer shawls. Let's see what's going on. And it's like, now there's people out there actually doing things and trusting. You know, instead of the accoutrements of religion, they're pressing into their relationship with God. Again, all of us guilty. Now, while Saul was talking to the priests, the turmoil in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. And the priest, and he said to the priest, withdraw your hand. So I tried to look up what he was trying to say there. I don't know if it was like he had his hand on his shoulder trying to counsel him.
Withdrawing his hand from the sacrifice.
Right. So that's...
don't do it.
Yeah. So, again, he's talking to the priest. He is trying to find out what to do when people are actually already doing things. You know, and there's a time we all seek God's, you know, what he has for us in our lives, but there's also a time when, you know, that can bundle you up and not so bad that you're so afraid to do anything that you do nothing. Or there's a time, again, back to, you know, Christianity is a set of parentheses, right? God never wants you to go a whole lot that way and a whole lot, and he'll keep moving those things till he gets you right where he wants you. And that's, there's a time to do something, there's a time to pray and sit still, there's a time, and we have to trust the Lord to help us navigate those parentheses in our lives as they start to close in and direct us what we're supposed to do. So again, Saul's finally trying to get with the program. He, again, still doing the religiosity thing and accomplishing nothing to this point.
I had a conversation with somebody about when you do something, it involves me praying. And I said, oh, you just pray. And, well, yeah. And I said, prayer is good. But you have to act. I said, we do things all day. We hope we're in the alignment with God, but as humans, we're not always in alignment with God. We are humans. And so you hope when you talk to the unsaved world, you don't just pray. You can do things and hope that we're still in alignment with God's will. And not just pray, just saying you pray unto him because, hell, you just pray. Is that all you did? And it's hard. People don't understand it. To just tell somebody that's all you pray, you gotta really go out past that. You pray, and when you do something, you hope you're in line with God, and if you're not, you hope God, which he will, in most cases, show you that you're wrong.
Kind of the book of James, right? Without any action, what's faith? You know, you can say, I have all the faith in the world. You could be the psalmist guy. You got the ephod, you got the Ark of the Covenant, you're speaking with the priest, you're there's people out battling.
Do it.
Right? So, again, parameters. There's always a time to sit down and talk to the Lord again. But once you got the word, it's time to go. You know, you can sit here and, you know, milk that cow for the next 6 months, or you can get up and do something. So, and that's, again, 10 fingers pointing back at me, or at least 9. Now the Hebrews had been with the Philistines before that time, and who had gone up with them to the camp, even they turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. So that's an interesting that you see spies, turncoats, collaborators, whatever you want to, Tories, right, is what we would call them in our history.
Yes.
That are with the Philistines, and even they have the sense to say, okay, this is going bad. I'm getting on a winning team, right? Likewise, when the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too were followed hard after them in battle. And the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth Aven. So I got it. Man, weird. Sorry, this is going to get, it's a weird. And the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day, so Saul had laid an oath on the people, saying, cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I have avenged on my enemies. So none of his people tasted food. This is like one of the biggest. Here, I was going to camp here for a little bit, because this is kind of like funny. The Lord has already won the battle. The people are fighting. But the guy who's on the throne, whether that be you on your throne, you let somebody else get on your throne, is now putting rules on the battle. The Lord's already won. You know, now it's just time to mop up. We can get this done. But somebody's going to put, again, let's stop and pray about this for the next. We're going to have, you know, 16 prayer meetings before we decide, you know, what we're going to do. Or we're going to, you know, here's the rules. If you're going to do this, you have to show up Sunday with a white shirt and tie, black dress pants. I mean, I'm being facetious, but you can put any amount of rules on this, but it's always, I remember when I first got saved, I couldn't shut up about it. And yeah, there's a point where sometimes now you hear new Christians and, you know, they get caught up in some little thing, caveat that they learn about, and that becomes their pet peeve, and you're like, I wish you wouldn't do that, you know. But there's also a point where you're like, in the beginning, you were just happy you were saved. It's like, man, I didn't even realize I was going to hell. Now I realize that I've been saved from that, and I want to tell everybody about that. But as you get older and become a more mature Christian, you know that you need to go to Bible college for 4 years before you decide to tell people about, you know, Christ. And we just put so many rules on when we let some guy crawl up on the throne in our lives, be it ourselves, be it somebody we hear on TV, be it some teacher that we really like, be it whatever. But it's just, I'll quit here because we'll get close, but this is just interesting. The verse before says, so the Lord saved Israel that day. Battle's won. It's over. It's a mop-up operation. And in the middle of that, Saul puts a rule on the people. And you're going to see it has very, very interesting consequences.
Well, foolishness of the rule. I mean, even the U.S. Army knew that the hardest thing to get to fighting men is food. And the sea rations came about. And people didn't really like eating sea rations. But when it comes down to being hungry or eating the sea rations, you ate them because you needed the nourishment to keep going. And that was, I mean, the U.S. government can figure that out.
and up to this point, I mean, I don't know, maybe he got it. At this point, Saul hasn't done really anything, right? All the other people are doing the battling, But he's getting to lay the rules down because he just wants to do. This is again. I'm trying to think. What's his name that laid the rule down that got his daughter in trouble?
Made an
oath, and it's like God never told him to do this. God's like, I already got this. I don't need any promises from you. We got this. But you're going to put some kind of, you know, I'm going to fast for 7 days before I, you know, do this. And there's, again, parameters of Christianity. There's a time for that. There's a time you might really feel led to say, hey, I'm really going to sit down and get in fellowship with the Lord and really, really hear from him. And this is what I'm going to do. But there's time to get up from that, you know. And, you know, God, I don't think God ever called you to monastic living and taking a vow of silence.
I think it's a dangerous thing to make oaths to the Lord because we're the oath breakers. We're the covenant, not keepers. So we just have to ask him to place his covenant in our hearts and obey it.
Yeah, I catch myself. I'm horrible about it.
Promises, and I really regret it. You know, like, oh, that was stupid because I can't do this.
I think that's why God said, let your yes be yes and your no be no. I catch myself, blah, 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 like I do here, and you're like, next thing you know, you've gotten yourself in trouble.
I will do this.
If you say,
let your yes be yes and your no be no.
I don't even.
The next verse, next part after
anything
that,
else,
anything else is from the evil one.
It's from the evil one. Yep.
And,
so he's thinking he's doing something really good here. I'm going to just.
Right, I'm going to throw a rule out there to just show how spiritual I am. And
y'all have to fast in this Lord.
Yeah. Yeah, he probably just had a meal, you know? Right. So I guess that's a good place to quit because we got to. Do you want to go on, or should I? We're getting kind of close. It's a good place to stop right here. Somebody remind me, verse 24 was where we ended. When I get next week, I won't remember.
God's going to remember that.
So, anybody want to close us a prayer? Anybody volunteer? All right.
Lord, I thank you for this day and this great message that we have and this great communion we have together, talking and sharing. And Lord, I praise you for the day you let us have this week of Thanksgiving, that we truly give thanks to you, and that we can at one time again be blessed by God as Americans. But Lord, it's only in your hands that it can happen. And be with everybody that's traveling. It's going to be a heavy travel day. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.